Hi, my name is Neda Bargi. I'm a postdoc in Christian Schlotter's group in VetMed Uni Vienna. And I'm going to talk about polygenic adaptation, specifically thermal adaptation in Drosophila simulans. I'm going to talk about recent interesting findings. There are quite heterogeneity among in the genetic basis of different traits in different organisms. There are some traits that have rather simple genetic basis. They're usually resistance to insecticide or viral infections. These are all guilty as charged Drosophila examples. That like resistance to insecticide is because of few genes ACE and then several family members of P450. And also in Drosophila C virus resistant is all because of majority is because of one gene called PASTEL, and then the same gene is involved in resistance to viral infection, both DCV and also Drosophila melanogaster sigma virus. But majority of the traits, they're rather complex with a lot of contributing loci. And then, for example, in human, height is one of the traits that has a lot of loci contributing to it. And in around 20 years ago, apparently doing QTL mapping was really in. So a lot of studies was done on Drosophila melanogaster, and then either for studying Bristol number, longevity, wing shape, they found a lot of regions being apparently responsible for these traits. And then in this example, you see that they found different QTLs in males and females, and also interaction of sex and environment. But in addition to the complexity of the trait, selection and standing genetic variation also causes repeated evolution of similar phenotypic traits. A very famous example of it is the armored plating in some sickle backs, where the gene response, the loci responsible for it, is in the common ancestor of them, of the populations that are in freshwater and also in marine populations. And after that, there were several studies, usually ENR studies, to investigate the genetic basis of a lot of traits, most of them complex traits, and few of them were well replicated, so that you could also look at the repeatability of evolution among the different replicated populations that they had. One of the one of the well-known studies is that three-decade experimental evolution in melanogaster, when they had different selection regimes, they're selecting for different developmental time, and then they found quite very little allele frequency differentiation among the five replicates that they had, and then when they repeated the experiments, I don't know, one or two decades later, they still found the same repeatability among the newly established replicates. And here, I think it's for one of the selection regimes that they had, and that is, shows the heterozygosity. And then these are five replicates mapped on top of, plotted on top of each other. So you see that there's pretty good repeatability across the replicates. Some theoretical studies suggest that because for when selection acts on standing genetic variation, especially for polygenic traits, because of genetic redundancy, you might expect less repeatability across populations. So in Christian's group, we are mostly interested in thermal adaptation, what happens to the genome when temperature shifts, either higher or lower temperature, and we do experimental evolution. And similar to a lot of studies, in the experimental evolution in melanogaster, there are a lot of candidate SNPs that are usually identified, and then those many SNPs might not, one might not think that might be responsible for to be the underlying basis of a trait. And I think Christian's group is, together with others, are the ones that actually they dug deeper to see what are the factors that they contribute to these amount of candidate SNPs being identified. So here is a is in melanogaster that they have been evolved for 60 generations to high temperature, and then the ones that are in red, those are the candidate SNPs being under selection. And then as you see these blocks, they show the inversion. So majority, like half of the chromosome, the selected candidates, they overlap with the inversions, and also the recombination rate is actually much lower in melanogaster compared to, for example, simulans. So both combined effect of inversions, low recombination rate, and long-range hitchhiking, that later on I will talk about it more, made identification of these targets of selection quite difficult in melanogaster. So Christian had an idea that let's use simulans because it doesn't have those long segregated inversions, and recombination rate is also higher. So we compared three replicates of simulans with two replicates of melanogaster. The populations, they started from different isofemal lines. Melanogaster had 100 isofemal lines, simulans had 200, but the selection regime was the same. They fluctuated between 28 and 18 degrees in a day, and then they both were selected for 60 generations. So we accounted for drift using neutral simulations, and then the black dots that you see, those are the candidate SNPs that the allele frequency change is more than under neutral drift. And these lines, they show different inversions that are present in melanogaster. So we see that the still seems that although the, we normalize the coverage so that the coverage would be the same among all the replicates of the two species, but we still see a much narrower regions in simulans, and majority of it is because the recombination rate is higher and they don't have inversions, and also suppression of recombination near centromere and telomere is lower in simulans than in melanogaster. So the data set that I'm going to talk about today is from Drosophila simulans that was collected in Florida, and they collected 200 isofemal lines, and in the lab 10 replicate populations were, 10 founder populations were set up, 5 mated female from each isofemal line, so a total of 1,000 flies. And then from then, all the replicates were kept independent from each other with non-overlapping generations, and the population size was constant at 1,000 flies. And every 10th generation from the generation 0 to generation 60, every 10th generation, we have pool seq data. So the first thing that we, and the selection regime is a hot environment which fluctuates between 18 to 20 and 28 degrees 12 hours a day with switch of light and dark. And so the first thing we did, we looked at allele frequency changes between the founder population and generation 60 to see what are the alleles that they change dramatically in frequency. So for that, since we had 10 replicates and we were looking for consistent allele frequency changes across all 10 replicates, we did a CMH test, and then these are the chromosomes X, 2, and 3, and this in y-axis, this is the log negative negative log 10 of the p-value of the test. And so so we have quite narrow genomic regions compared to melanogaster, and then since this test doesn't correct for drift, so we did neutral simulations, assuming independent loci, of course, but we kept the coverage, a number of loci, and everything similar to the empirical data that we had. And then this is the 5% false positive rate. So anything above that, the allele frequency change is more than what we expect on their neutral drift. But then it was the question of, we already kind of knew from melanogaster that when you see what we call them peak or chimney, it's not only, not all of the SNPs in that region are selected. Majority of them are just hitchhiking with target or targets of selection. So for that, we had this mission of finding these chimneys. So how we can define a chimney and what are the borders and boundaries of it. So we focused our analysis from SNP-based to finding these regions, so to include the neutral hitchhiker SNPs as well. So before I go ahead with the method that we used, I noticed quite that different replicates were kind of different. So as an example, I have 10 replicates. These are two of the replicates, replicate 3 and 4. 3 is my favorite one because it has a lot of peaks, and wherever in the genome you look at it, there's always allele frequency change. But for replicate 4, it still has some peaks, but they're not as prominent, and then the Manhattan plot looks kind of like flat. So looking at other ones, we found other replicates that similar to this one. They had peaks, but the peaks were different regions. For example, in this replicate, replicate 5, you see that the first half of chromosome 3 seems to be selected. But if you look at the same region in replicate 8, there's no allele frequency change, and it's just the middle of this region that seem to be selected. And that applies to, the pattern is the same for all 10 replicates. So to have a look at it systematically,
Apologies, how did you generate your replicates? At what point have you split them? What was the initial crossing scheme?
They were outcrossed for 9 generations before the base populations were set up.
So there's a single base population from the 200 isofemic.
There is one single population.
This gets to the conversation we had yesterday.
There were not 10 different base populations separate collected in the wall. There was one single collection event of 200, and then the 10 replicate founder populations were set up from the same 200 isofemala, if that is the question.
But also, could you put some quantitative assessment onto your statements that they're substantially different? Because to me, they actually seem quite similar.
I will show in the next few slides what I mean by different.
Sorry, just so I have a sense, do we know what the recombination rate is in the simulants? How many crossovers per chromosome?
I think it is 1 per 1 centimorgan. But it is higher than in melanogaster, and also we have computed recombination based on the few founder populations, founder haplotypes that we had, and there is a decline near the centromere and telomere, but it stays relatively constant throughout the whole genome.
So LD in simulants is something like 100 bases, extends to 100 bases. But it is not to say that low-frequency haplotypes from which selection operates here, right, what rises in frequency, that the length of that haplotype will be 100 bases. It's probably much longer.
You're just wondering, over 60 generations, take these two peaks on 3R that you were talking about. In 60 generations, would we expect?
Well, those are million bases or so, something like that, right?
Pardon?
Those big chunks, those peaks, million bases or something like that.
Yeah, there are several hundreds of KB to MB. Right.
But in 60 generations, do we expect a breakpoint to happen between those two peaks, given the recombination rate in simulants, or during the experiment, not before setting up the population?
I will show later on that after 100 generations, 4MB region was not chopped off because of recombination, if that's
right. But just to make very brief calculations, so half time your chromosomes are in males and half time in females. So in males you don't have recombination. So 60 generations means 30 opportunities for recombination, right? And I don't know what are your initial frequency, but some proportion of your individuals would be homozygous, right? So recombinations between homozygous stretches would not be meaningful as well. So I suspect that you would have 25 or so events per chromosome in terms of recombination over your history.
And why? Crossover per
chromosome, approximately.
And why the initial haplotypes would be, initial flies would be homozygous? Because they're not inbred.
No, it depends on frequency of your allele. So, for example, if your frequency of your allele goes to 50%, half of your individuals are homozygous. So recombination is immaterial in them, right?
In later generations.
So you kind of need to account for that a little bit.
Okay. Okay, so to show the differences among the replicates, I did Fisher's exact test to compare the allele frequency changes between the founder and generation 60 for each replicate separately. And then, again, performed neutral simulation to see, to find candidate SNPs that the allele frequency changes more than what you expect under drift. And then I compared them across the 10 replicates that we had. Data not shown here, but there is a few candidate SNPs that are shared between two, three, or more replicates. And then I looked at, compared the p-values of the SNPs from that we had from CMH test, and I compared it to p-values from Fisher's exact test. For CMH test, values above 28 are those that we call our candidates, and for Fisher's exactness is around 30 or so. So the ones that you see are colored in red are those that are candidate SNPs, have been identified as candidate SNPs using both tests. But the ones that are in yellow, they've only been picked up by Fisher's exactness and not CMH tests. So that shows that, for example, for replicate 3, the majority of candidate SNPs in this replicate, they're also been picked up by CMH. But that is not the case, for example, for replicate 8. There are a lot of them that you can find them only if you do Fisher's exactness for this particular SNP. And then, we have these boring replicates that when you account for drift, it seems to be no allele frequency change is more than what you expect only because of drift. So I pulled all the candidate SNPs that I had from Fisher's exact test and CMH test to have a better representation of SNPs that the allele frequency change has been prominent during the 60 generations. And I ended up with 55,000 candidate SNPs. And now going back to the method to see how we can include, take into account the neutral hitchhikers that we also have in our data set, it is based on a simple principle that if low-frequency haplotype increases in frequency in the experimental evolution, the allele frequency trajectory of selected SNP is correlated with allele frequency trajectory of the hitchhikers. So if you look for correlation among trajectories in across time and across your replicates, you will be able to find clusters of SNPs. And as an illustration, this is a simulated data. So this is haplotype. The black one is a founder population. Founder frequency at the founder population, green, blue, and red are at generation 20, 40, and 60. And then, of course, not all the haplotype length increases in frequencies, but the region that increases in frequency, you will be able to reconstruct this block. And then later on, I will explain a bit more how it's done. So we started from 55,000 SNPs, and then I conditioned it that the minimum allele frequency change should be 20% in at least two of the replicates, and I polarized it based on the rising allele, whether it was minor or major. And then we had window size of 1 MB, and then we looked for correlation coefficient, Pearson's correlation coefficient of 0.75 among the SNPs. So how it is done,
I ask you a question.
Sure.
Might be like you were trying to use Christian. So what was the rationale for choosing 1 MB? Because you might have underlying ideas that suppose you are speaking about very low frequency SNP, and it is sitting in some haplotype, and that haplotype is rising, and like it might be represented in like five of your initial 200 strains, right? And what is an overlap among those like SNPs, spike SNPs, from which you initiate selection response, you pull consistently like 1 million bases which is shared around them. That is one interpretation, right? That would be initial sampling linkage disequilibrium. Your another interpretation might be that you are tracking those events of recombination which happen during population, during your selection regime, right? But in either of those scenarios, in the first scenario, 1 MB feels a little bit too long for me. And in the second scenario, it feels a little bit too short to me. So I'm just curious, what was your...
We have played around with the window size from 100, 300, 500 KB to 1 or 2 MB. And then I will explain how it is done. The shorter window size, they won't allow you to reconstruct the block as accurately as the longer one, but we didn't see much difference between 1 or 2 MB. Of course, it might affect it, but since we kind of validated in our with experimental haplotype, so I think 1 MB would give you a good window size to find the blocks. But of course, all these parameters you can change and play around with it. So usually we start the genome scan from the beginning of the chromosome here, since I didn't have a big peak in there, so I put a window here, but it usually starts from the beginning of the chromosome. So you have your window over there, and then you, from all the rising SNPs based on these criteria, you make a correlation coefficient matrix and of all of them, and then since we do have a threshold, so we cut this dendrogram according to our correlation coefficient, so that the average correlation coefficient among the SNPs in each cluster should be our threshold, 0.75 or above. And based on that, we categorize, we put the rising SNPs in this region into different clusters that here is shown with different colors. And then after that, you slide the window with 50% overlap, and then you repeat the same thing, making correlation coefficient matrix. And then now that we have two windows overlapping with two different sets of clusters, and then since we have 50% overlap, then we look for the clusters that share SNPs between the two windows, and then if we see, for example, between more than five SNPs, then we extend the cluster that we have. And it's a good way because if you imagine neutral SNPs that are close to the selected target, they are more tightly linked rather than those that go further apart. And in this way, since we extend the window and then we look for some overlap, we allow for the looser correlation of the SNPs that are further apart, for example, from the target of selection. And so using this, we perform this clustering genome-wide. And you do not need to really pay attention to the colors, but each of these is colored. SNPs is one cluster with high correlation coefficient of 0.75. But then we had a look to see whether do we really expect that all of them are really independent of each other. And that is exactly the same thing that Sergey mentioned yesterday. When we see different peaks, each of them has some candidate SNPs. Are they all linked or are they all independent? So what we did is that I looked at allele frequency trajectories of these guys here. And then for each color, I'm not showing all the allele frequency of all the SNPs there because then it would turn into a band that you can't see anything. So each color is the median allele frequency trajectory of the clusters that are here. So looking at three of the replicates, we noticed that although they start from a wide range of allele frequencies in the founder population, but they all go up together. And then, of course, it might be just by chance, but even in another replicate, we saw that they all go up to frequency at generation 30, and then they then plateau or just go up and down, as you see here. And then, again, we have some replicates that, like, except for two or three clusters in this region, none of them seem to increase, or even they have slight decrease. So what we did next is that for the SNPs that were present in these clusters that we have found that the allele frequency is correlated among them, we relaxed our correlation coefficient so that we can put actually merge the adjacent clusters together.
Sorry, can I ask a quick question, I guess, about this? So in the first round, the one you just showed us, things were only clustered together, like 10 things, that they all shared correlation coefficients above your threshold?
Yes.
Or is it the average, all of them?
No, the average correlation among all the SNPs in a cluster should be 0.75 and higher.
Average, okay. So one guy in the middle wouldn't cause you to split it up?
No.
I understand why you want to merge things close together, but sincerely, I would be interested in playing with other ways of merging as well, because it is, again, not clear to me what those signals of non-independence come from. From just transmission through very few lineages during selection, or from linkage disequilibrium, physical linkage disequilibrium. I simply don't know.
So besides combining those that are physically close together, what other...
Yeah, might be they share genealogies. I don't know, some of those more remote clusters, and that would be very interesting to observe, in my opinion, at least.
Okay, so the final set of haplotype blocks that we have in chromosome 2, this is the chromosomal position, this dotted line is a centromere. And so all those clusters that were present before, all different ones, we put them in one cluster. And then later I will show the frequency of this haplotype block, and then later on I will show that there's construction actually have worked well, and then we have found them in haplotypes. So this is the frequency of haplotype, this haplotype that I showed, haplotype block in the 10 replicates. So here in the x-axis we have chromosomal position, and in the y-axis we have frequency, and then in black is the frequency of this haplotype at generation 0, the pink one is frequency at generation 30, and then the green one is at generation 60. And I don't show the intermediate ones because it would be crazy and not easy to follow. So, and then each dot is the average of allele frequency of five SNPs. So for replicate 4 that we saw in previous slide, that they all increase up to like 60 or 70 percent. Here we all see that this initial block, it increases in frequency like 40% after 60 generations. And then we also see increase in, for example, replicate 10, when after 30 generations we saw the plateauing. We also see that frequency of generation 30 and 60, they kind of are on top of each other. We also see some increase in replicate 7, for example, and like around 10% in replicate 1. But going back to the heterogeneity among replicates, for the other replicates, we don't see that much of increase for this block. For example, in this replicate 9, all three time points, generation 60, 30, and the founder population seem to be on top of each other. So we kind of see heterogeneity across the replicates when you look at these haplotype blocks. And then just to validate that the method is able to reconstruct the haplotype blocks that are rising in the frequency in the experiment well. Yes?
I have a question on the last slide. So if I understand it correctly, they should all basically have the same, so if they should all basically follow the same base, they should be have some function plus one offset with which they all share, right?
Yes.
But then it seems that some of them are spiked in the middle, like in R8, for example. So how would that work if they are?
Okay. Like in this one, is it what you mean? Because initially, not all the SNPs in this position have the same frequency. Some of them here is higher. And then that might be because here we reconstruct the whole like block, but there are some regions of it that might be shared with other haplotypes in the same population. So that is why when we get the frequency from pool sequencing, you here get a higher estimation just because at this position, other haplotypes also share these SNPs.
Right, but then if you go to the, if you look at R8, for example, so there are the, like the green one, in, like around the center, goes up like very dramatically, while, so that's not just common baselines. I wonder where that comes from.
For so this
the
one,
green minus the green minus the black one should be a constant. Theoretically, right? And that seems to be not the case there. So I wonder, like, how to understand this, whether it's just a byproduct, whether...
That, I think, is just because when you reconstruct this block, because for the regions that are shared with other haplotypes, you get a higher estimation. And then if for some reason, if other ones are constant and then they do not change, so it won't change at all. But if other ones are also increasing and then they share this IBD region with the haplotype block that we've reconstructed, so we get a higher estimation, but not because this block is increasing, because we don't see an increase for the whole length of it, but another block for, is increasing because other parts of it is selected.
Okay.
Not sure
you.
If I'm clear.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
Sorry, can I just ask a quick question? Yeah. So, which of these ones were was the haplotype detected on?
For 10, all of them, they have increased for this block.
Right, but like when you tried to figure out which SNPs were on the same haplotype, that was just looking at one replicate or two replicates or something.
What do you mean, which SNPs?
All replicates.
All replicates.
Oh, you mean for reconstructing the block?
Yeah.
All of them, yeah. But depending on whether that region increases in frequency in this replicate, the signal might come from different number of replicates.
Right.
But we initially condition on two replicates, so as the minimum number of signals should come from two replicates or more.
So I guess my biological question is whether, you know, R9, where you don't see the change, is that because the haplotype is actually different in R9, and so on average the things aren't sort of going up how you expect, or is it because they were sort of the selected locus is somewhere else outside of that window, and it just happened to be dissociated in this replicate?
You mean why this block is not increasing in this replicate?
Yeah,
is that the question?
Yeah, I'm trying to think about it. Because the R4 looks super convincing, right? Like, that's a whole block. It's going up together. Then R9, it's also kind of convincing, and then nothing's going up, but it seems so different.
But the question is why it doesn't increase in frequency.
Why doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah,
I can wait for some years.
Because I don't know which slide of mine you're talking about, but one of the major reasons is because they're low frequency, so they just may get lost because of drift.
Okay.
That's one reason.
Yeah, I mean, I find R10 really cool too, right? Like, clearly
because
the haplotype exists,
flat,
but then it somehow got...
I expected it should go down if for some reason, but it just plateaus at that 40% or 30%. Okay, just to validate the blocks that we have identified, we made some crosses, so we made back crosses. We have an inbred line in the lab, and then so we get a virgin female, and then we take one male from their evolved populations, and then we cross them, and then we sequence one female progeny. And then for this female, because we already know the chromosome that comes from mom, because this is our reference genome, then we can easily infer the parental chromosome easily. So we made, since we knew we have quite heterogeneity across our replicates, we made 100 crosses from 5 of the interesting replicates. But now we're making crosses from uninteresting replicates as well. So I will explain how, so these are the plots that I'm going to show to see the structure of block. haplotype block, we constructed one in the phased haplotypes. And then for the subsequent plots that I'm going to show, the coloring and everything would be the same. So here is the chromosomal position. Each line is one SNP in this reconstructed block. The one that is red, 100%, that is the reconstructed block of ours. And then each row is one haplotype from this particular replicate. This is replicate 4. So for each position, I compare the position in the allele in the haplotype to the reconstructed block. And if they are the same, I paint it the same color, red. If they're different, it gets the color of green. And then the yellow ones that you get, those are the ones that have low frequency, so we don't call them. Good question. The haplotypes were reconstructed up to generation, from data up to generation 60. Here, the flies come from generation 88. And here, you see that 1 here, 2, and 3, at least 3 of the haplotypes, they have the whole reconstructed block intact. Even, and yeah, that's the disappointing point, that even after 28 generations, the recombination hasn't broken up this block. We have some haplotypes that's like the 5 prime or 3 prime, are different, and then we might think that this might be because of recombination, for example. But there are other regions, haplotypes, that they have, they share small parts with the reconstructed block, and then they might be just IBD regions that initially were present in our population. So, but the cool thing is that we can actually experimentally validate the blocks that we identify with this method. So this was a very simple case of haplotype block that all the SNPs increase in frequency together, and then we can also find it in our evolved haplotypes. But I'm going to talk about a difficult situation here, and then I will come to conclusion that the structure, the LD structure of the haplotypes in the founder population, it kind of affects the signature that you see after you look at your experimental evolution after 60 or 100 generations. So here, this is a block that, quite interestingly, it spans the central mirror and it extends to both right and left chromosome arms. And to look at it a bit better, I divide it into smaller genomic regions based on the stringent correlation coefficient that we had, 0.75. So these, I don't know if it is obvious, but there are two long peaks very close together. And then here I zoomed in, so I show these two peaks here. And then I have colored them with different colors just to distinguish different genomic regions. And I hope I don't confuse you, but I try to explain it well. So here, this is the peak that we looked at. So I have divided them into 5 different genomic regions. So the first one is this dark pink one. So each column is one replicate. In the x-axis, we have different time points from 0 to generation 60. In y-axis, we have allele frequency. So this one, this is the allele frequency of the second genomic region in between. So these two make the first peak in this genomic region, and then the last 3 make the second peak here. So I put this bar so you know this is first peak, this is second peak, and these are the replicates. So the first thing is that we still have this weird, boring replicates that they don't seem to... that these blocks don't seem to be sweeping in them. One of them is replicate 6, for example. And interesting ones are like replicate 8 and 9, that they seem to go up like to 20 or even 40%. But after that, they decrease in frequency or they somehow stay plateaued. That I don't know why this is happening. Anyway, so we have... replicates that for all these genomic regions, like in replicate 3, you see prominent increase from like really low frequency up to 80% for all the genomic regions, for the whole block. But since we have heterogeneity among replicates, we have 2 weird ones. Here in replicate 1, you see that the last 4 genomic positions you don't see allele frequency increase at all. It just stays up and plateaus. But then for the first genomic region, which is our first peak here, it goes up to 40%. Yes?
I don't know, Pedro, not in your experimental design, you have some notion of selection response. But it would be so interesting to compare that schema with like how much response you have to your selection.
Based
like, for example, rep 3 might be moving fast and the rest might be moving slow, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you had phenotypic data. And another question, which is a little bit apologies, I'm not sure I'm on right target here, but might it be that some of those haplotypes of yours are functionally equivalent? So you kind of pick one or another. And I appreciate that they're a little bit misplaced, but might it is like some place in the loop of chromatin, or I don't know, something strange.
I will show something in the next few slides. We think they might belong to a family of haplotypes, if you can call them.
Sorry, am I just misunderstanding? I mean, to me, wait, this is convincing evidence that there aren't two peaks. Is that what people are getting here?
What do you mean, repeats?
I mean, there are two different peaks here. There's like one peak that's moving together.
I'm not sure that I agree with your statement.
Because, I mean, otherwise, like, why should it be the case that, I mean, with the exception of this one top left thing that you just said, right, in the vast majority of cases, both peaks are doing the same thing in the same replicate.
Okay, second.
There's a tremendous amount of difference between replicates. So, like, they clearly can do very different things, and they do very different things in the replicates. But whatever they're doing in a given replicate, the whole region is doing the same thing.
But what is also interesting is that the region between them is seemingly not doing the same thing.
Yeah, so that's...
So it is not like spatial, it is distributed signal. This is precisely what I was trying to allude to yesterday,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But I mean, in that sense, it's not two separate peaks in the sense of two different things that are independent.
So, and this is where I was kind of saying, hey, might be this genealogist, which is important here, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I would be curious about what exactly is going on in between.
I mean, why they're not increasing frequency?
Is sequence along the chromosome? Is that how you order them top to bottom?
Pardon?
Or the...
Yes.
I mean, and in between, for instance, like, I mean, maybe it's just the case that those alleles, like, started at low or at high frequency, and so they're also moving, but they just don't have anywhere to go. Yeah, if they started at high frequency or something.
Well, you showed some pictures like that earlier, too.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, maybe, like, a better thing to look at, rather than, like, looking at this change in allele frequency, which is a kind of raw measure which is dependent on the initial allele frequency, right? One can look at, you know, between your initial and final time point or between any two time points, a sort of effective S, which is like, you know, how much it moved proportional to where it started, you know, assuming that there's some logistic function or something. And then, I mean, that's going to be overly messy, but might give you some handle on whether the things in between are not moving, are really sort of not moving, or maybe they are moving but just have a different initial frequency and can't get anywhere.
But even in these ones that are in the middle, and then we have picked them up, but it's just they don't increase in frequency.
Well, see, like that stuff in the middle, it has to be moving.
Yeah.
It has to be moving in conjunction with those loss alleles. But the point is that an initial sample, it doesn't have to be fully linked with those alleles. It might be linked with crop load of other stuff,
right,
which might be moving down. Yeah, and this is why you don't have consistent signature.
But another interpretation is that these SNPs there are shared between the selected and non-selected haplotypes, so you have no net increase.
Exactly, right, yeah.
And that's why you don't get it. So estimating S or whatever wouldn't help you with this, because you would dramatically underestimate it. This is the drawback of PULSI.
Okay.
in a way, like, this kind of data, it seems like across, you know, you've got a lot of replicates, and you have a nice thing here in that these two regions, they're doing very different things across replicates, but within a replicate, they're always doing the same thing as each other. So, like, that's a signal that you could look for across all peaks, you know, in general, which suggests that things are being driven by, you know, linkage due to Sergey's suggestion or for some other reason, but that they really aren't separate signals.
Well, it's a big question. It is which of them is target of selection? Because this is the ultimate question, right?
Yeah.
And how do you figure it out?
Okay. As I said, for replicate one, we see that only the first region increases in frequency, and for replicate four, if you assume that's the driver of this region, this block is in the first region, this one, it only increases in frequency at generation 40, and it's the other peak, the second peak, that increases in frequency quite dramatically. So luckily, we had haplotype sequences from replicate 1 and replicate 4 at generation 88. So looking at them, the whole coloring pattern is the same as before. Red is the reconstructed block. If it is red, it means it's similar, green different. And now for these five genomic regions, I've separated them with these orange bars. And then the allele frequencies are also in the bottom, so you can follow it. And this is in replicate one that we see an increase only for the first region. So quite surprisingly, we still find haplotypes that they have the whole genomic region of the reconstructed block still in them, although it doesn't seem to be increasing in frequency. And then in the first genomic region, we have some haplotypes that they only have SNPs in this region, and that, although 20-something generations later, that might explain why we see an increase only for this region. But we still, what the region that we have reconstructed is still intact and still present in this replicate. And looking in replicate 4, where we saw the increase in frequency for the latter part of the block, this region, block also, we still have at least four haplotypes that they still have the intact block region in them. And yeah, a lot of haplotypes with pieces of that they share with the original reconstructed block. But then we also have three or four haplotypes that they only have the latter genomic region, which might explain the increase in frequency in the latter part of this block. So after seeing that, it's kind of still a bit, it shows that the region that we have reconstructed is the in one piece, and that's why we find it in evolved population in different replicates, although they don't seem to increase in frequency in all of them. Where is the target of selection, or which part of it is responding? That was still a question. So we did have a sequence of founder populations, the isofemale lines that were used to establish the founder population. So it was a joint effort of PhD student in our lab, Thomas, and a super technician, Viola. Although we started from 200 isofemale lines, each have male and female and two chromosomes, and so we might have started from 800 haplotypes. So here we only have sequenced 180 of them, but it still is pretty good. So now the height of the rows are much lower and smaller because we have 180 of haplotypes. But still, this is the block that we reconstructed with these five regions. So what is really interesting is that if you look at this region here, you see that it's quite red for the whole region. So meaning that we have found the whole block in our founder population. But the surprising thing was that we had few haplotypes that they didn't have the first part, but they had the last four genomic region of this block. And then still, we have some blocks that they only have the genomic region of the second peak and not the first peak. And to make things a bit more complicated, we have haplotypes that they have the first two genomic region. We have haplotypes that they only have the latter part of it. So that is, I think, what suggested this haplotype family, the LD blocks that you have initially in your founder population, they determine what might get selected in each of those replicates, and you get different signatures. Yes?
I would like to propose very strange exercise, but hopefully it might eliminate something. Mm-hmm. So if you have your initial set of haplotypes and you know your frequencies of each markers, you can try to figure out at what proportions you can admix those initial haplotypes to reconstruct the distribution of frequencies along that window that you observe as an outcome of selection. And then you would be able to see like what changed these frequencies of each initial haplotypes. And I think that it would be very illuminating.
Not sure I completely understood what you proposed. Do you mean based on the number of haplotypes that we found in our base
population? Just try to construct the picture on your right by taking all those haplotypes and multiplying them by some frequency, right, and summing them over. Some of them might be zeros, some of them might be tens, and then you would know what selection and drift have made frequencies, these frequencies of your different haplotypes, right? And that would be kind of probably quite illustrative in terms of understanding what the heck is going on.
And does it help that we don't have all the initial haplotypes?
Yeah,
we have 25%
perfect,
of them
but
only.
But might be it would still be right, worse an exercise.
Tens or twenties of possible solutions?
Well, I don't think you will, right? Because you have much more markers and you have degrees of freedom. So I think that it will actually be identifiable, I suspect.
I mean, could you just do it like five parameters for each of the blocks, peaks that you see, and then you have more than five replicates, so that should give you enough.
You mean to put each haplotype in one replicate to see?
Yes, you have 10 replicates, and then you sort of know sort of some measure of fitness effect of each one of the peaks. The initial pool, and so that tells you how they're connected.
And then what you could do, I would assume, it is after you describe that selection coefficient to haplotype, you, for example, can even do some kind of GWAS on those selection coefficients to see what SNPs were driving it, or blocks of SNPs were driving that selection. And maybe it would be like too much of analysis, but again, it could eliminate something in terms of what is going on here, right?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well.
Christian, am I making myself clear or it is idiotic?
I'm not sure you have only a few degrees of freedom. That's what I'm not so sure. But it's an interesting idea, trying to basically play around with the frequencies of the different founders, whether you could recapitulate what you find after some generations. It's an interesting.
Okay, you have 180 things, right? And you have, I don't know how many SNPs are here, but like say 1,000 or 2,000 SNPs, right? So GWAS with 180 genotypes and 2,000 SNPs seem like much more conservative than what people have been doing, so it should work.
Okay, so a short simple or a complicated case that we had. And here I'm showing the size distribution in chromosome, as an example, in chromosome 2. So one interesting thing is that we have a quite size variation in the reconstructed block. There are some of them that are pretty long and some of them that are actually much smaller. The other one is that we have blocks spanning central mirror to extending to both chromosome arms. And then if you look here, there are regions that we were able to reconstruct several haplotypes. And that might suggest that we might have some competition between different haplotype blocks as well. And then in total, in the whole genome, we had almost 100 blocks. And then a majority of them are 100 KB or smaller, although still very big. But we have majority of them, like half of them, they're even up to 1, 2, or 4, 5 MB. So they're still pretty long after 60 generations. And so we were interested to see whether to explain the heterogeneity among the replicates, whether this is a function of starting allele frequency and selection coefficient. And to compute those, for example, this is the block that I showed before, and then before I showed the allele frequencies along the chromosome, and here I just show here in the x-axis are different time points. This is allele frequency, and then each line, yellow line, is frequency trajectory of an allele. And then as you see, although they belong to one block, but then the starting allele frequency ranges from like 0 to 60%. And then, if I want to use all the information here to compute the starting allele frequency and also selection coefficient, that would be the, for example, median. And it might not be a good representative of the block because there's a wide range of SNPs in this region. So what we thought would make sense is just to go back to the initial genomic regions that we had in this block based on our stringent clustering. And then these are the median of the allele frequency changes for each cluster. And then I computed selection coefficient for each of them. And then the assumption is that although the whole block increases in frequency, but the region that is under the strongest selection is the region that is driving this block. And then based on the identification of region with the strongest selection coefficient, I use this one to compute starting allele frequency and selection coefficient for each haplotype block. And then based on that, so here these are 10 replicates, and then these are the rising replicates, whether block increases in frequency in 1, 2, 3, and so on and so forth replicates. And in y-axis, we have starting allele frequency of the block. So almost half of the block in sweep in only half of our replicates, and it's just because the starting frequency is low. And then as the starting frequency increases, you see they sweep in more replicates, and then this red line shows the median. And I also computed selection coefficient for each of these clusters, and then still in the x-axis we have the number of replicates that they show sign of sweep for that particular haplotype block, and here's selection coefficient. So we have quite a high estimation of selection coefficient for all of these blocks, and then these are usually higher for the replicates, for the blocks that increase in frequency in only one replicate. But we still, for all of the identified blocks, the estimated selection is still pretty high. And having known that, we went back to our original 10 replicates to see how many of these blocks we find in each of those replicates, whether the numbers are equal or not. And then we do find, although there are some variation among replicates, but we see that in all of them, we see majority of the blocks increasing in frequency, but the numbers do vary. And then I was interested to see whether we do see particular enrichment for any gene function or category in this data set. So we took all the SNPs that were present in these haplotype blocks, and meaning the signal comes from all 10 replicates, and then we did go enrichment analysis. And then we found quite interesting pathways. For example, OXPHOS pathway, which is responsible for metabolism in mitochondria, was one of the enriched ones. And also we have some genes with oxidation reduction process that are particularly involved in triglyceride biosynthesis process. Also some genes that transport monosaccharides across membrane, some that are involved in dopamine and melanin biosynthesis. and also some with endopeptidase activity, some transcription factors, and some that have involved in taste receptors. So using the goal categories that were enriched in our data set, we started phenotyping our populations first to see whether they have changed compared to the ancestral population, or, and then second of all, the most important one, whether selection of different genomic regions in our replicates would result in the phenotypic traits being different in each replicate, or they would all converge to the same value. So this one is the resting metabolic rate, which is the amount of carbon dioxide that is produced overnight at 18 degrees when the flies have the least activity. And then the flies were maintained at a common garden experiment so that so we reduced the maternal effect. So in the you see that for the females, evolved ones, hot evolved ones, they produce significantly more carbon dioxide compared to the founder population. But I do not see this response in the males. And also, we have RNA-seq data for these flies, and then we see that OXPHOS pathway is actually, the expression is actually reduced in the hot adapted population. So it's, there's kind of discrepancy why, despite low expression, they still manage to produce more carbon dioxide. I think it might be because of mitochondrial copy number. We still have to 100% test it. But the hypothesis comes from indie mutant because they have quite good longevity. And then after day 20 of their age, they down the expression of different complexes of mitochondria decreases, and also the activity of these complexes decreases. But when they measured total ATP, the indie mutants, they still have more or less the same ATP produced compared to the control ones. And then when they looked at the mitochondrial copy number, the mitochondrial copy number in the indie mutants is actually higher than the control. And then the model is that to just minimize the side effects of reactive oxygen species in the, those stressed cells, they increase the density of mitochondria but minimize the workload for each of them. So that is why they can manage to produce the same amount of ATP despite downregulation of the whole metabolism machinery. So I looked at our PoolSeq data. Although our PoolSeq data was not designed for looking at mitochondrial copy numbers, and because they were only frozen for PoolSeq. But I looked at the ratio of mitochondrial DNA to autosomes, and we see, and these are different time points and then the coverage, so we see an overall increase after 60 generations, but there are some regions, time points that have like lower copy number, and I do not know why is it so, but to have it in a more systematic way, I did another common garden experiment to and then I froze the flies in different time points for 30 days, froze males and females, and then we're going to look at the ratio of mitochondrial copy to the nuclear copy to see whether we have a systematic increase in our evolved population, and that might explain the increase in carbon dioxide that we see. Later on, we measured body fat, as was suggested by our goal enrichment analysis, and then in our females, their stored triglyceride is actually much lower compared to the founder population, but I still do not see any response in males. And we also measured fecundity as a measure of fitness, the amount, number of eggs that each female lays in a day. So at day 2 and 3, those are the egg-laying days that the eggs go and are used for setting up the next generation. We see an increase in fecundity of the flies compared to the ancestral population. So we, So we showed that in different phenotypic assays, the evolved populations, at least females, are different compared to the founder population, but whether we see differences among different replicates. I thought this would be much cooler, that selection of different regimes would result in different phenotypic values, but that is not the case, so we don't see any significant difference in metabolic rate or in lipid content, and also for fecundity. So that would mean that despite differences in the genomic genomic selection that they have, they've all converged to the same to the same phenotypic value, at least for these three phenotypes that we've measured. And with that, I would like to summarize that we've shown that thermal adaptation in experimental evolution studies is in Drosophila simulans is a polygenic trait. And then, although in different replicates, different genomic regions are selected, they've all converged to the same phenotype, meaning whatever evolutionary path you take, they would all lead to adaptation. And as we've shown that selection is standard genetic variation, it might not all the time result in repeatability at the SNP level. Depending on which level you're looking at, you may have repeatability at SNP level, but we didn't have it, but we saw convergence at the phenotypic level. So repeatability is kind of a function of the complexity of the trait, the sorting allele frequency of the selected haplotypes, and also the reservoir of mutations. And we were also able to identify quite high haplotype blocks with strong, with high estimated selection coefficient. It's not similar to what you would expect under an infinitesimal model, that you would have a lot of SNPs, each with small effect. And so one might argue that the signal might not come from one target of selection with large effect, and it might be because of a combined effect of a lot of smaller effect ones. But based on what the enrichment that we see in our goal enrichment analysis, that might suggest that the beneficial alleles that we have are not probably randomly just distributed across the genome. They are distributed in the key genes that are selected in our population. And with that, I would like to thank Suso with a lot of help for the clustering, Thomas for doing the crosses and also for estimation of selection coefficient, and Mollis for statistical help, and all these funding agencies. Thank you. Questions, comments?
Why didn't you give that talk at the beginning of the whole thing instead of at the end? It would have helped us have a different conversation. So that's amazing. So how many of the blocks did not show selection?
We can't find the blocks if they don't show, if they don't increase in frequency, we can't find them. So all the blocks, if I understood you correctly, all the blocks that we have found, they have been selected in at least two replicates. Otherwise, we won't. And then we can only reconstruct a part of haplotype, rising haplotype, that increases in frequency, because if it doesn't, we can't.
But you went back and created haplotypes.
Oh, you mean to look at the flanking region?
I was thinking of the experiment where you sequenced the individuals from the population and then looked at the haplotype structure.
Yes.
So there was presumably haplotype runs.
Yes.
That
yes.
Were in regions that were not under selection, or not, or could you not define those?
The issue is all these haplotypes that she has been shown were basically only conditioned on the SNPs that were included in such a peak. This is not a normal LD analysis.
I see.
This is just things.
So what happens if you do the full LD then?
Nothing. It's similar to what I showed you, that if you look at the R square with distance, you see that this nicely drops even after 60 generations or something. It's just a bit shifted upwards compared to the ancestor one.
Well, I think this is critically important, so that's why. So if you do it with the full data set, you see no signal of haplotype structure?
Averaging across everything, that's the problem. You average, because these kind of R-square plots are across the entire genome, and so you don't see this. But this is a very local thing.
That's a separate question. Those R-square plots are of debatable use, but when you can map LD across a chromosome, mm-hmm. and then that's different than averaging. You can look for how markers are in LD across the chromosome. That's the question I'm getting at. That when you look at that, you don't see evidence for LD, irrespective of what the markers are.
We have not looked at it, but we've looked at LD for the whole chromosome, but we immediately drops, I think, after like a 1 kb. In the evolved populations, it is, as Christian said, it is a bit higher than a founder one, but we still don't see these long blocks just by looking at LD.
Yeah, but the situation is quite complicated, what you asked for, because if you look at every SNP, it's the same thing, even if you move it along a chromosome. You have all the bulk. If you look at these CMH plots, you have a bulk of SNPs at the bottom that have basically zero significance, and these are the ones that are basically not showing anything. They're shared across all the things. Mm-hmm. And so if you try to move along, you will not see a clear signal. Mm-hmm. That's just because you look at too many SNPs. It's a noisy, really noisy statistic, and I don't think this is really informative. But some things that Neda and others have been doing is kind of they looked at kind of IBD stretches that you find, and in this population, I think we don't have much IBD, but if you look in another population, you find more IBD in particular. Then in the evolved ones, suddenly you look at this, you sequence a diploid, while not isogenized ones, and you find stretches. You can have basically a half chromosome being identical, a full chromosome being identical
in
a single individual, not between population, in a single individual. This shows that suddenly you start getting blocks there that are no longer mixed up by recombination. This is kind of what you expect because of the combined action of selection and all this. Then you have massive, massive, massive LD in the evolved populations. This is massive what you have.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about where the signal should arise and where LD comes, and then we only see this LD arise in regions that are under selection, or will there be other
find
things?
You find it in other. This has nothing to do with the targets of selection. This is completely. We have done too few. This was maybe, 50 individuals or what we see.
Well, it could be generated by the Hill-Robertson effect, for instance, or something like that. And it'd be interesting to see that accumulate over time.
Maybe you mentioned that, and I just missed it. Is there any correlation between the length of these blocks that you detect and your estimated strength of selection, or for that matter, just the magnitude of frequency shift?
I have looked at it, selection coefficient being the response, and as a function, I had size of the block, the length of a block, and then starting allele frequency and the number of SNPs. Usually the starting allele frequency and the number of SNPs, they explain some variation, but not the haplotype block. It's just the number of SNPs.
So the length doesn't...
No, and it's. I think it's just because of the way that... Because if it starts from low frequency, it has a lot of private SNPs, so we can use the information and then we reconstruct a bigger block. But when it starts from higher frequency, for some regions, it might not increase in frequency, or it might be shared with other ones, so we reconstruct only a smaller region.
But you also expect a smaller region. That's also, if you have more haplotypes than you to start with, then your block should be
smaller. Yeah, it should be smaller.
So it's not clear what is more an artifact of the reconstruction or a real biological...
Or the nature of the,
Can you remind me the effect of population size for the... For the replicates?
For 291 is the median across all 10 replicates. But for each of them, I computed it separately. I don't remember exactly what those were, but 291 is the median.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.